Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. While Israeli airstrikes, drone attacks, and tank shelling continue to decimate the Gaza Strip, 22 months into this genocide, Israel continues to implement its policy of forced starvation on Palestinians, killing hundreds of children, men, and women so far, slaughtering nearly 2,000 at so-called aid sites and plunging the entire population into catastrophic levels of hunger and malnutrition. A new statement published in the medical journal The Lancet, authored by a group of scholars and physicians, including Dr. Ghassan Aboussita and Ilan Pappé, says that, quote, starvation is being used repeatedly and relentlessly as a weapon of war. The genocide in Gaza, the letter adds, is a defining ethical test for the global public health community, social scientists, and academic associations. Silence is not an option. As scholars and health professionals, we face a stark choice. Either we uphold our collective ethical responsibility and speak out to prevent further mass violence and starvation, or we will be remembered for our selective silence and inaction during one of the most urgent moral and public health crises of our time. Joining us to talk about the current medical catastrophe in Gaza and Israel's use of starvation as a key weapon in the genocide is Dr. Ta'er Ahmed. He is an emergency physician who has worked in Gaza for years, including during the last 22 months. He's part of Healthcare Workers for Humanity and joins us from Chicago. Ta'er, it's so great to have you again with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. Well, we last had you on our live stream in February 2024 when you had just returned from working at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. You've been trying to return to Gaza, but in the meantime, you've been working with other healthcare workers around the world, trying to support your colleagues there and build solidarity movements. When we talked to you then, the medical situation in Gaza was already on the brink of a total collapse. And now, a year and a half later, hospitals are experiencing a full-on catastrophe. Healthcare staff are saying that there's no more blood in the blood banks and people can't even donate blood because they're too malnourished. Basic equipment and medications are at zero stock. And we've all, I think, run out of words to accurately describe what's happening. First off, give us an overview of what you're hearing from your colleagues in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, it's catastrophic. The issue is that the conditions that were being implemented back when I went have been pretty consistent with very little reprieve. The siege has only tightened. It's only become more suffocating. And so it's not just really the hospitals, but it's any sort of institution in Gaza that supports livelihood or life in Gaza, the ability to sustain it, that has been totally cut off from the population and from the organizations that traditionally help in these settings. I'm talking about groups like UNRWA and the World Food Program and all of these other international organizations. So the border and the entry into Gaza has been severely restricted. And so what we're seeing is that there is a total deprivation of everything that a human being needs to be able to thrive. And in fact, we're getting to the point now where it's causing the deterioration of the people in Gaza. And this is all happening under the guise of airstrikes, tank shelling, ground invasions, displacement orders. And so you have this sort of man-made humanitarian catastrophe on one end, and then you have this full-on assault into a very urban area, a very small area that keeps growing smaller and smaller. So, I mean, it's hell on earth, and that's exactly what my colleagues on the ground are describing it as.
Yeah, indeed. And I want to spend some time talking with you about starvation and what it means in terms of how it affects the body. For children and the elderly in particular, tell us about how starvation occurs and the physiological effects of this policy, Israel's policy of plunging Gaza into this crisis.
Yeah, I think the best way to echo sort of the study that you alluded to earlier is to understand that starvation is an assault. It's an attack on people. So this is something that is far beyond just depriving people of the food that they need or not allowing them to get to the calories every single day that they would need to be able to live a healthy life. So that's the first way to understand this. How is this assault being manifested? It's in the total obstruction of food entering. It's the total restriction of food getting into the Gaza Strip. So understanding that, what you're seeing on the ground right now is that's happening in a context of unclean water, unreliable access to water, as well as overcrowding and conditions that are allowing disease to spread between person to person at a very rapid rate. So I think you would have to understand starvation is very separate than hunger. It's the feeling of hunger is different than the process and the assault and the attack of starvation. So this is when you start to see the effects of this, the first signs of which are, of course, people are reporting that they are losing weight unintentionally. This is not somebody that's going on a diet, not somebody that is engaging in more physical activity and reaching their target weight. These are people who are trying to go about their day that are losing weight at a rate that is unsettling. And I remember back in 2024 speaking with my colleagues, and they were talking about losing between 10 and 20 kilograms just in a few short months. And one thing that most Palestinians and Gazans will show you, they'll show you pictures before the genocide and they'll show you pictures now. And they look like completely different people. For any public health professional, that's very alarming when they're starting to tell you, this is unintentional. I didn't do this because I wanted to do this. This was forced on me. And that is like the first thing that we are able to recognize. We are seeing that people have lost a tremendous amount of weight, that the muscle that they once had is wasting. The most extreme examples of this would be looking at people who are bodybuilders in Gaza. And there was more than a fair share of them. You see pre and post, and it shows you what happens to the muscles. I mean, they're just basically vanishing before your eyes. And of course, that corresponds to people having decreased energy levels. People's blood sugar levels are decreasing. Their inability to tolerate different temperatures, that starts to manifest. It's really hard in the winter times when you're being starved. Your body's not able to generate the heat that it needs. You're not able to if you've ever gone outside when it was really cold, you tighten up. And so if you're losing some of that muscle that allows you to tighten up and try to create more of that heat on your body, what happens? You have hypothermia. And that starts to affect your heart rate. It can affect your blood pressure. It can cause all sorts of things. And so I think that's probably like these sort of initial physical effects that you start to see in people. And when you start looking at children who we would describe as vulnerable populations, anybody that you really want to protect from this because they don't have the same adaptability as normal, healthy adults. You think about kids who are breastfeeding. You think about children under the age of 6 months, under the age of five, really, or children who are premature. You think about pregnant women or breastfeeding women. You start to think about the elderly. You think about people with diabetes or high blood pressure, all of these things, people with medical conditions. These people, this happens at a more accelerated rate. And they struggle with this a lot more. But what are, the sort of consequences that this has on somebody is, I think, what's particularly concerning. Because as you're losing muscle, as you're losing your ability to regulate the temperature of your body, as you are growing weaker and with more fatigue and less energy and you can't maintain your blood sugar levels, what that puts you at risk for is that your immune system is not going to be able to mount the sort of response that it needs to for regular infections, for upper respiratory infection like a cold, the common cold. That means that they will have it longer than they typically would if these weren't the conditions that were in place. That means that they will get sicker, and that means that they're at higher risk for this to cause some serious morbidity and mortality. They could potentially die as a result of this, and that is a preventable, unnecessary death, all because there is a policy over time where you are restricting the amount of food that was entering and the sort of starvation that we're seeing. Then the other thought that you think about is Okay, so we're noticing that we're putting them at risk, that they are struggling, that they're not going to be able to handle additional insults. Well, we cannot ignore the fact that there are fighter jets that are dropping bombs on these people, and that is doing it in an indiscriminate fashion. And so while you are being starved and you're struggling with this, that means that if you were to miraculously survive an airstrike, that you are going to be at high risk for not being able to heal properly, potentially dying as a result of an infection, as we mentioned, but also that you're going to, your body is not going to be able to heal the way that it normally would heal. So permanent disability as a result of this situation that you've been, that's been thrust upon you. So that's very, you know, that's kind of like the immediate effects that you're starting to notice, the things that really concern you. Now, two things that I'll mention. There are now about four nutritional stabilization centers. And these are set up in conjunction with the Ministry of Health, the World Health Organization, all the NGOs on the ground, that what they're trying to do is they're trying to assess and figure out of the kids that are able to come to these clinics, who is malnourished and is it mild, moderate, or severe? And the reason you want to identify this in children especially is because they are still developing, they're still growing, and you know that every day that passes that they are under these conditions of malnourishment, especially the severe ones, you are gambling with their future. They have cognitive issues that will result as a, that will develop as a result of this, that will be irreversible. Again, the immune systems that they try to develop will not be as strong as they should be. They will be weaker immune systems. They will have short statures compared to what they would have normally been able to, what size they would have normally been able to grow to, and even developmental delays, not reaching the classic milestones that we see kids reach, right? Like, you know, even their crawling and then walking or then speaking, all of these things get delayed. They get pushed back because of what we're, what, you know, what's being inflicted on them. And, you know, that's sort of, you know, something that I think is alarming enough. But again, just to sort of get deeper into this, what we're doing is we're shaving years off of their lives on the back end. These kids are at higher risk to develop chronic diseases, you know, hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, cancer. And so the life expectancy changes. So again, when you hear somebody like President Trump say, we've got to feed them, you're not really grasping the devastating and horrifying thing that's happening to Palestinians in Gaza. It's not just about getting them cans of tuna or bread, which, you know, kind of, I think, is the other thing that I think is important. If you watch videos of the soup kitchens in Gaza right now, what are you seeing? You're seeing just big bowls of rice, or you're seeing, you know, people getting a cup of soup, right? I think when you hear the words balanced diet and getting all of the food groups, exposure to the food groups, that's not happened consistently over 22 months. Over 22 months consistently. You know, you can't, you will not find a Palestinian who can tell you that they, when's the last time that they had something that's high in protein, you know, other than lentils. Like, I mean, that's, you know, that's something that they may be exposed to. But everything else, it's not there. You're not seeing that. And it all becomes interconnected, right? When you talk about ecocide, well, that, you know, the Gazans had a very, you know, had an opportunity, or not opportunity, I should say, is the agricultural opportunities on the fertile land that existed there is being decimated, not just for the interim period right now as this war on the civilians of Gaza rages on, but that sort of effect persists towards for a very long time, that you can't just suddenly grow crops the day that the fighter jets land and stop, you know, scrambling above head. So that is concerning. That's a public health emergency. So, and just to bring it back again to not being exposed to the food groups, the developmental delays, and these kids that are showing up to these nutritional centers, even the nutritional centers are not able to operate at the capacity that they need to. They're overwhelmed, they're understaffed, they don't have enough fuel, and they don't have the supplies that they need when they identify that a child, for example, is high risk and has severe acute malnutrition. that child needs monitoring, needs close follow-up, needs the ability to get these high energy biscuits or these different types of formulas that you would normally be able to give a child. That's not happening here. Again, it's because the Israeli military is maintaining a suffocating siege while also devastating the population with, you know, with their military. So, you know, all of that kind of works together against the civilians in Gaza. Everything is working against their ability to sort of succeed and to thrive. And the proof is just looking at month to month. Each month that we kind of move forward with this whole-scale stoppage of food entering into Gaza and, you know, the failure that is the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, we see that there is a rise of people who are dying as a result of the severe malnutrition and the starvation. And again, I think suffice it to say that we know those numbers are an undercount because we don't have the resources or the capabilities to be accurate, but it should be alarming. I mean, this is, you know, very alarming to see that you are approaching 200 people in 2 months starving to death, almost half of which are children. And so that's why it's just, you know, it's very concerning to me, but also infuriating when you have, again, the New York Times publishes about the kids that have starved to death. They have the very horrifying picture on the cover of that. And then you get the next day, there's an addendum or something about, oh, this kid had cystic fibrosis. Yeah. Ask any doctor if that changes how they're viewing the starvation in Gaza. Ask any public health official, any nutritionist. Ask anyone, does that change? No, it's very concerning. Yes, cystic fibrosis kids are more at risk. But this is like canary in the coal mine sort of scenario here. And, you know, you should, if something like that happens, something, that sort of tragedy happens in front of you, it's not about trying to figure out, oh, well, he was sick already, he had some other medical illness. It's about mobilizing all of the resources that you have to be able to assist what's happening in Gaza. And that's also not happening. So, you know, it's it truly, truly is horrifying. And I think pictures of hungry children are not accurate in the portrayal of just how tragic it is on the ground.
Thank you for that. And yeah, I mean, if you could talk a little bit more about, you know, the New York Times just, you know, deranged addendum to that story, yeah. You know, really like as though living in Gaza under a siege that didn't just start 22 months ago, but it was a 17-year-long siege. You know, compounded with high levels of pollution, the destruction of the agriculture, airstrikes, psychological trauma, everything, as though those aren't pre-existing conditions, which is also a very American concept. What is a pre-existing condition? That's just for insurance companies to deny coverage, right? And as though disabled children shouldn't be afforded the care that they need, as well as, you know, able-bodied children. I mean, the whole thing, like it's so disgusting. Can you talk about that? Talk about the kind of this effort by corporate media and Zionists, you know, online. You know, they're all screaming, you know, there is even Netanyahu, right? Like, you know, there's no deliberate starvation in Gaza. Those children, you know, had chronic conditions before the whatever. Mm-hmm. Talk about the if we want to call them pre-existing conditions of that children have in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'll say is it's, I think, for people who have even just a tiny bit of knowledge about, you know, how the body works or have some background in healthcare, some background in physiology, when they see Witkoff or Huckabee visit for 1 hour, you know, one of these distribution sites that are actually slaughterhouses, you can't come out and say there is no famine or, you know, there is no intentional starvation. You don't know what you're talking about. And everybody that does know what they're talking about thinks you look like a fool. And I remember even in the last days of the Biden administration, his ambassador to Israel killed an IPC report, you know, and the IPC reports are actually these really important reports that humanitarian relief organizations use to guide how they respond and use to decide how much resources they should allocate towards a response. And they killed this report in December of 2024 about famine-like conditions being achieved in North Gaza. And the argument from the ambassador at the time was, oh, the actual number in the population is inaccurate. They're going off of faulty numbers. That's dangerous. And in my mind, I'm like, no, he's the dangerous one. That's not how you respond to a report saying famine-like conditions, even if they got the numbers wrong. The idea is you want to over-respond. You want to be able to say, all right, what do we got to do to support the people? What do we got to do to support the communities here? And that's the other thing that I think is important to put into the historical context that Palestinians, especially in Gaza, exist under. So if we have a siege from 2006 that has been implemented, where at various points you have ministers that have said things like we need to put the Gazans on a strict diet, and things like even and different food items are being banned from entering. So just deciding that there are certain food items that will not be allowed to enter, that can help you better understand how this population may be sicker than the population that's only a few miles away in Tel Aviv or, you know, in other parts. So that's, I think you have to put it in that context. There have been incredible data published by, I can't remember the name, the Palestinian Center for Research. But what they do is they publish a lot of data, and they were looking at kids who were essentially dealing with some sort of stunted growth. And the numbers, of course, as you can imagine, if you're living under a siege and you're living under aggression after aggression over the last 15 or 20 years, the numbers were higher in both the West Bank and in Gaza. So it goes to your point, too, that, the sort of impact that occupation, apartheid, and escalations have on our vulnerable populations, it doesn't go away. And then when you have a horrifying genocide unfolding, then you are seeing it almost be put on steroids, and you see just how far you can push the body's breakdown. And so, I mean, that's, to me, like very concerning on so many different levels. I mean, you can just look at life expectancy pre-October 7th between Israelis and Palestinians, and there's a statistically significant difference. You can look at the rate of mortality for common diseases that exist. So if somebody has heart disease and is Palestinian versus if somebody has heart disease and they're Israeli, they're 2 to 3 times more likely to die from the heart disease. And, you know, these are all horrifying things that existed prior to October 7th. Now, after October 7th and because of the way the Israeli military has prosecuted their activity, that I can't even imagine what that number is. We can't even begin to study it in a way that, would be effective to relay the message. But we all know that this message is going to be catastrophic by any means. And I think one other thing that I would definitely say is the psychological effect of all of this, because you cannot separate mental health from physical health. I mean, they're intertwined and they are, very much related and influence each other. And so when Save the Children is telling you before October 7th that there is a dangerously high number of children experiencing mental health trauma in Gaza, so much so that we're seeing higher rates of bedwetting, higher rates of self-harm behaviors, higher rates of suicidal ideation. Well, those kids tend to have health issues, tend to be more malnourished than a child who doesn't have to deal with that same sort of trauma. They have more issues. They get sicker more often. They miss more school. You know, they aren't reaching the same sort of developmental milestones as the others. So this is all related, all connected, and all goes back to the same source. And it goes back to this very powerful, sophisticated, advanced nuclear power military imposing that on that population that's there. And so that's what's concerning. And again, it's kind of, again, it's interesting because you get to see how everything is so connected. That is why you can't talk about humanitarian principles without talking about the occupation, without talking about, what's happening to Palestinians and the political decisions that are being made.
It's like it's so layered, the these compounding and reverberating and generational effects of Israel's policies and including the policy of starvation. I
Yeah,
mean,
compounding is the operative word here because that is
right.
exactly what it is, you know.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
it's tough. It's really tough to digest because it definitely is a web that takes you into so many different areas, and when you start to really start peeling back the layers.
I mean, as a doctor, walk us through, if by some, miracle, Western states that have the power to do so forced Israel to comply with its international legal obligations, as whatever value legal international law has these days. But that aside, if we were living in a separate timeline, and the siege ended tomorrow, and the crossings were open, and these tens of thousands of trucks that have been waiting at these crossings to enter, just a few kilometers away from where children are starving to death. If Gaza was flooded with adequate and more than adequate amounts of food to be, agriculturally sustainable, that the farms would begin operating again and the water would be clean and all of this, there's something called refeeding syndrome that we've been hearing about. So for those children who are in the catastrophic stage, the IPC phase five stage of starvation, it's dangerous then to also just immediately start consuming food again. I mean, can you walk us through what this is and what it means and what children are supposed to do, and how to care for them right now?
I mean, so refeeding syndrome is something that you worry about with your sickest, with the sickest, I guess. We'll refer to them as our patients because it's a medical emergency. With your sickest patients, you worry about refeeding syndrome. And the easiest way to sort of explain it and to is to say that as you starve to death, your organs begin to shut down, your body begins to waste away, your ability to just even function as a normal, independent human being starts to vanish. And so, in a very twisted way, if you are somehow presented with all of the adequate nutrients and calories that you need in food while this process has already started, your body wouldn't know how to process any of that. And as a result of that, you may have all sorts of problems, including in your inability to break it down and digest it, or the electrolytes that and the nutrients that are in there causing problems for you, like having seizures, risk of death, having a coma, going into a coma, cardiovascular issues. And so that's, when you are talking about catastrophic levels of hunger, which is what, IPC phase five is referring to. You're talking about for every 10,000 people, there are a certain number of deaths every day. And when you reach that point, you have to worry about refeeding syndrome. But what makes things more complicated in Gaza is that you may get to this point without necessarily saying, okay, we're in IPC phase five. This person's been hungry for this long. Why? Because this person could be injured at any moment. He could be riddled with bullets near a distribution site. They could be injured in a bombing. And so those patients, especially if they need to have surgery to save their lives, they're more quickly to be at risk for something like refeeding syndrome. And then finally, the concern about this is the way we typically manage and deal with refeeding syndrome. It's a very resource-intensive process. And the reason that's the case is you need to constantly be getting blood work. You're checking people's sodium levels, their potassium levels, their phosphate levels. You're checking their sugars constantly. You're checking their blood pressure, their heart rate. You need staff to make sure that they're consistently checking on the person's mental status. Are you still awake? Do you still know where you are? Are you sleeping too much? Is your oxygen level okay? Are you breathing too rapidly? Or are you breathing too slowly? So very resource-intensive a process. Now, if your hospital is being targeted, it's under attack, maybe the diesel fuel is not reaching it, so you're not even able to keep the lights on, maybe your staff has been abducted, or maybe you're short on staff because you can't pay them and they need to go to the distribution site to grab food for their family. Maybe you don't have the supplies that you need. You don't have the tubes for the blood to even collect the blood. You don't have the analyzer to tell you what the sodium level is in someone's blood. All of these things are compromised in medicine. So again, for me, it's what I worry about is, this is all on a spectrum when we talk about starvation and hunger and malnutrition and refeeding syndrome. It's all this like very connected spectrum. But we don't have the tools that we need to be able to identify where we're at on the spectrum, to be able to pinpoint and label who's most at risk, who's doing okay. And so that's why we know, and it kind of goes back to a point we mentioned earlier, that everything that we're saying is sort of just from like a naked eyes view, knowing that if we are really going to investigate this and finally be able to look into this, it's going to be very ugly what we see.
I mean, yeah, I just think about all the intensive care units that have been destroyed by Israel over and over and over again at, Shifa, at Nasser, at Al-Auda, at Al-Aqsa hospitals. I mean, all of these places where, a child who needed that amount of care is not going to get it.
If you think about some of the things that we've seen, like at Rantisi Hospital, which is a children's hospital, you talk to some of their staff and they're saying, well, we're really over capacity. So now we're starting to, put some of the premature babies next to each other. And then you think about the shortage of baby formula. These are all things that are sort of happening all at once, all at the same time. And, I think when it comes to especially the vulnerable population, so let's take premature babies, for instance, if we're not able to give them enough formula that they need, it's a very mathematical calculation. Like, this is how much they weigh. This is how premature they are. This is how much we want to be giving them every single day. If we can't consistently or reliably do that to them in this phase, and we start to ration and we start to split it up, and then we can't keep them warm enough, we have to put them next to each other. The risk of death just climbs so high in these babies. And so even, to be a premature baby and to survive, you're kind of beating the odds depending on how premature you are. But I feel like when it comes to the hospital system in Gaza, for all of the patients who are sort of in these very difficult, tense and stressful moments in their lives as they're battling to survive, we definitely are not doing them any favors, but it's like we're working against them to try to accelerate it. I mean, that's what it feels like is happening to so many of these kids in these hospitals. And so it's beyond, it's really beyond me to sort of think about how in a 360 degree fashion, the ability to heal in Gaza has been compromised. The ability to treat patients has been compromised. The ability for doctors to, maintain the standard of care. It's all compromised in a way that's, again, deliberate, and it's a policy that's being implemented.
Can you talk a little bit about other populations in Gaza, for example, the elderly? And the effects of starvation and genocide on the elders and what you're seeing in terms of their ability or inability to heal from injuries and chronic disease and just normal processes of aging throughout all of
this. I mean, you refer to them really as these a population that's silently suffering. Part of it is that, you're not going to necessarily be able to see the signs develop how they normally would in somebody. You're not going to be able to necessarily pick up on rapid deterioration, especially in the elderly, especially in people with limited mobility. So if somebody has a disability or somebody is elderly and they're not able to get around as much, they're not going to have the access to care where somebody's picking up on some of these signs that they may be struggling or that they may be having memory loss or they're losing independence or they are, more, they're, they're taking more shallow breaths and they seem to get tired a lot quicker and their legs are swollen and, you know, they are complaining of, you know, dizziness, lightheadedness, vertigo. These are all things that are happening, but they're not, no one is assessing it and no one is able to evaluate it because once, you know, it's a very, you talk about access to care and it's like, no, this is so many of the vulnerable populations and especially the elderly, it's like prevention of care. We're not no longer talking about a lack of access. We're talking about an active prevention of them reaching any sort of care that they would need to just be able to fight any of this off. And so you will see, you will really see, especially when it comes to elderly and with people who have medical conditions. I mean, you will see how it absolutely overwhelms them in a really slow, painful way. Like it's a tremendous amount of suffering that will take place. And I think, you know, the other thing is the part of what makes it difficult too is a lot of times, and we had even seen this, there would be somebody who has some sort of respiratory chronic illness like COPD, or they have heart disease, or they've had a heart attack in the past, or they have heart failure. And oftentimes what will happen is they'll be brought to the hospital at tremendous risk to themselves and their families at really late stages of some, you know, exacerbation of this process. So they are really sick, they are really critically ill, and they don't, and you just, you know, you essentially see this person come to the hospital, die in the hospital, and then have to be taken away by their family, or they're brought already dead. And that's happened multiple times. I mean, I've not just seen it in the elderly, but I've seen it in children who have cerebral palsy, like really debilitating, disabling cerebral palsy, die as a result of the conditions that they were living under. And what I can't definitively say if that was the result of malnutrition or starvation, or if it was because of the freezing temps, or if it because it was the tent was so hot and they over, you know, you just, you, but you know that the, all of it contributed to that, right? And so it's really tough to, you know, it's at least from a medical professional standpoint, a public health perspective, it's just really tough to kind of sit there because you are, you know, you're just, you're handcuffed on so much of this. And I think, you know, it's important to also mention, you know, like breastfeeding mothers and pregnant women. It's like, you know, they're no different than anybody else in the population with respect to the effects of starvation and hunger. And we depend on them, right, to at least nourish the youngest of us if they're able to, especially breastfeeding mothers. And if they're not able to produce the milk that they have, it's an indication, first and foremost, that they are in a really bad spot from a health perspective. But it's this vicious cycle where that child is not getting the nourishment and the nutrients that they need, and they're becoming more malnourished. And it's this sort of additional psychological burden on the parents who are unable to provide their child with what they need to grow and to recover. And it's absolutely devastating. And that stuff, there can be a ceasefire tomorrow and there can be 1,000 aid trucks and everybody can survive it. But that stuff never leaves any of them, not the child, not the parents. So, you know, that's, again, it's another consideration that, you know, you're not going to hear on the mainstream media. You're not going to hear CNN talking about that, the struggles of breastfeeding, you know, mothers or of pregnant women. But it's a reality that's forever altering the future of that, of our community in Gaza, of the population that's there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a form of psychological torture that, yeah, you know, a couple has, you know, has a baby that they bring into this world with all of the hopes and the dreams and the joys, you know, that they want for this child and their family. And to not be able to feed your child who is starving as you yourself are starving, and there is no formula. And mm-hmm. even if there was formula, it might not be the right kind. If the baby has, you know, special dietary needs, or, you know, or the there's no potable water, the water is contaminated. Children are getting Guillain-Barré syndrome, which can lead to paralysis. It's a very rare disease, you know, here in the so-called West. But I think there have been like dozens of cases of Guillain-Barré.
Yeah, and it all goes back to really the kind of the conditions that we are forcing upon the people of Gaza. So what you're getting is a bunch of viruses spreading because the sanitary conditions are not able to be maintained. There's no clean water. And then as a result of some whatever these viral illnesses are that people are enduring, they have this sort of autoimmune reaction known as Guillain-Barré or GBS. And that's causing this, it's a horrifying disease because it's an ascending paralysis. So you really, the weakness starts from lower, from your feet and starts to move up. And if it gets to your lungs, you have a chance of suffocating to death and not being able to breathe because the muscles in your lungs are becoming paralyzed. And, you know, you identify that in these hospitals and there is treatment for it. Here in the United States, when we see it, there is treatment for it. But for example, what I got a message the other day from a doctor at Luxa saying, well, they needed the filters for the machines that would administer the treatment. And I would think about this treatment a lot like dialysis. It's just sort of like this exchange that's kind of moving through. So, you know, blood coming in and out. And you need diesel fuel at least to be able to hopefully have electricity so these machines can be plugged into the power. And then you need the filters, which are probably on some WHO truck that's outside being blocked by settlers and the Israeli military. And then after that, you need to clean all of that and use it for the next patient that you get. And so from A to Z, you know, you're screwed, you know, and that's really what's so problematic. So Guillain-Barré is just like in the setting, just like it was polio, just like it, you know, could be hepatitis A. All of these things should be expected given the scenario that on the ground and is just one emergency after another. We'll move past Guillain-Barré because the Palestinian healthcare workers will find a way to somehow treat people and many people will die unnecessarily, but then it'll be the next thing, you know, and that's, you know, that to me is like, I mean, I can't, the burden that's on these healthcare workers there and the burden that's on the communities and the trauma that they're enduring, that's one thing, but it's like, I mean, how much longer can this, can even that be sustained where it's like you're not even able to really offer any sort of treatment. You're figuring it out. You're MacGyvering whatever you can. But, you know, how long is that going to go on for?
Yeah. I mean, there has really never been a red line for Israel since its inception. And the sense, you know, this genocide is the culmination of a century of impunity, of naked supremacy, of settler colonial violence and of you know, entitlement to be able to do all of this to people.
I think you bring up a good point about red lines, because then we can see where we got if we just look backwards and see how certain red lines have been crossed by the Israelis. You can go back and remember that the World Central Kitchen convoy that was coordinating with the Israeli military, providing their coordinates. This is the World Central Kitchen. They were providing a, now they're not doing it anymore because they can't, just like any other organization. But you're talking about hot meals that are being provided. There was a triple tap. I mean, three separate cars hit with missiles, killing all of these aid workers. Then you look at Oxfam, who in Khan Yunis in November of 2024, four Palestinian engineers, water engineers, are trying to repair water infrastructure. Again, coordinating with the Israeli military, getting the green light, deconflicted, whatever that means. And they go ultimately killed. Then you could talk about the ambulance drivers or the paramedics, right? We saw what happened in Rafah with the Palestinian Red Crescent, trying to go with their lights on and everybody trying to save some of the injured, all shot to death, gunned to death, except one who miraculously survived. Or you can talk about Ahmed and Yusuf, the paramedics who are trying to save Hind, who got the green light, who we have the recordings and we have the Israeli and the missile strikes. Or we could talk about Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya or Dr. Nahid or Dr. Abu Salmiya, all these people who were abducted and some of whom are still abducted. And then you could talk about over the 1,000 healthcare workers who've been killed. You could talk about all of this one by one. It's just all you. Then it makes it should be no surprise to anybody that we're now dealing with starvation and famine. It should be no surprise whatsoever that people are dying unnecessarily. And yes, you know, I think that's part of the frustration of people just framing it in the context of let's bring them food, let's feed them. But that's because, you know, there's been no accountability for any of the things that we just mentioned. And, you know, I mean, that's in conjunction with just sort of an indiscriminate assault, right? Like just absolute leveling of block by block, home by home, shelter by shelter, school by school. So, yeah.
I mean, you know, as we wrap up, can you talk about the level of this kind of consistent dehumanization of Palestinians that has led to this point? Where, you know, as you said, this live stream genocide has been unfolding for 2 years, but it is against the backdrop of a century of you know, this impunity. And, you know, the quote, you know, best that Western politicians can say they can do is send a few planes for airdropped aid packages that kill and injure people, you know, or are filled with rotten or inadequate food, while not doing anything to sanction, isolate, and stop Israel at all costs. What does this say about our collective responsibility, and what on the other hand gives you hope in humanity at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is that you know, any sort of principles, standards, I think we've demonstrated just how hypocritical we are as a global community when it comes to Gaza. And, you know, you think about even this idea of airdrops, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, all of the responses, all of the solutions are so detached from what it, you know, from any sort of like actual on the ground human experiences, interactions, you know, trying to do needs assessments. No, that's the dehumanization in effect. If this was anywhere else, you would have people on the ground talking to different families, trying to make sure that they have what they need, looking at this from a holistic perspective. But because it's Palestinians, and because there's been such a deliberate effort to dehumanize Palestinians, it's all about just fill up whatever, some of these aircraft carriers, drop a bunch of this aid. If it lands in a tent or in the sea and somebody drowns trying to get it, or somebody dies being crushed to death, we, you know, at least we did our part. Or let's hire a bunch of mercenaries and militarize this and, you know, herd people like sheep and get them slaughtered. So that is how you see the dehumanization in play here. I mean, it's a total contravention of like traditional, and which is not perfect, but traditional like relief and aid delivery. You're just eliminating that part of the equation and saying it's okay because it's Palestinians. And I think, you know, you just look at silence on so many different levels, so many different professional societies, so many even politicians who refuse to sort of acknowledge anything deeper than like hunger, or, you know, civilians are, you know, maybe being hurt by this. And, you know, we want that. I mean, all of that is as a result of sort of that dehumanization effort and successful campaign against Palestinians, and just the hypocrisy and lack of consistent principles, and then like a moral consistency and approach. And I think we found out too that all of the mechanisms that were created after World War II really hold no bearing, and there is no actual foundation that they exist on, because they can be applied only when it sort of suits the overarching narrative by the most powerful of nations. Otherwise, if it's inconvenient, it's what you see playing out in Gaza right now. So that's what I mean. For me, that's, you know, again, how all of this ends up being connected, right? Like, yeah, I can be an aid worker, I can be a doctor, I can go volunteer, but none of it means anything if all of this remains in place. It'll be a very short-term, minimally impactful, endeavor if you cannot change the reality on the ground, which is, again, day after cannot look like the day before, you know, and hopefully we get to a day after. Who knows if we'll ever get to a day after. But what does give me hope, I think, you know, at this moment is, yeah, it goes back to, you know, the Palestinians, their culture, their incredible capacity to love, their ability to maintain to their identity, watching that transcend like all of the efforts to push that down and dehumanize that, and watch it result in almost 100,000 people in Sydney marching, watching people, you know, go to the embassies and locking the gates of different embassies that are complicit in what's happening, watching people like Miss Rachel use her incredibly large and far-reaching platform to talk. To me, that's what gives me hope. The people are what give me hope. The Palestinians give me hope. And then the ability for people to see past the garbage and see the Palestinians for who they are. I mean, that's what gives me hope. And it's a tough battle. I won't lie. I mean, it's a tough struggle. And of course, I would be honored to go down on the side of the people, regardless of what the outcome of this is at the end of the day. But to me, that is what gives me sort of that hope. And I will caveat it with one thing, though. I think it can be very dangerous, though, to take the incredible characteristics of Palestinians and just the rich history and the culture and the. I think it can be dangerous if we use that to sort of, make make them appear superhuman, or to, you know, say, hey, this is resilience and this is their hero.
Yeah,
absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. That would be a failure on our part. I mean, that's not what this is about. They are suffering. The fabric of society is being attacked and is trying to be ripped apart. And they're dealing again with a very advanced military superpower that is implementing very insane policies right now. And so, they did their part by being able to just sort of survive. But we can't, we can't keep pushing it to the limit the way that it's being pushed to the limit. We can't expect them to endure this forever. At some point, that's where I think we come into the equation. I guess at the end of this, it's like, that's our call to action, right? Like, figure out a way where we're not doing that, and we're able to confront sort of some of the things that that we talked about. Yeah.
Dr. Thaher Ahmad, you are always just such a important voice, and I value our conversations so much. And I'm just so grateful for all the work that you do and are continuing to do. Tell us finally about Healthcare Workers for Humanity and how people in the healthcare worker community, healthcare community, can get involved.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a collective of voices. You know, this is not a formal organization by any means. It really is just a collective trying to come together with one voice, try to gain as many people to join the movement as possible, just to be able to take back the values that this profession is supposed to be built on. I mean, that's really it. It's that simple at the end of the day. The leadership in many of the societies that govern the healthcare world have utterly failed us, and they are morally bankrupt. And the idea is, many of us got into this not for any other reason, but to be able to connect with other human beings. And that's the way that we want to manifest that connection. And we want to be a force for good at the end of the day. When you are 6 feet under, and it's all said and done, you hope that you can be a net positive. And so I think that's the idea. And we just, you want to sort of build a coalition together to stand in solidarity and to at least be able to say, you're seeing something unfold, you're seeing something happen, and it's not going to be, it's not something that you're willing to accept.
Thank you so much, Thaher.
Appreciate you. Thank you. Thank you.